My guest is Paul Hendrickson. In 1958, at the age of 14, he entered St. Joseph's Preparatory Seminary in Russell County, Alabama, the first step in his chosen path to the priesthood. It was the logical extension of his solidly Catholic upbringing in suburban Illinois, but 7 years later, and just 6 weeks shy of ordination, he left the order. "When I left," Paul Hendrickson writes, "I was 21 years old, a virgin, scared stiff. I had never met a Jew. I had never been on a date. Most of my cultural heroes had saint affixed to their names." He's written a memoir of his experience in the seminary and his re-entry into the secular world. It's titled Seminary, A Search. Paul Hendrickson says he wrote it as an ambivalent believer who has twice married and no longer regularly attends church. Paul Hendrickson is a staff writer for the Style section of the Washington Post. He's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize 3 times and is currently at work on a biography of Robert McNamara. Seminary, A Search, is published by Summit Books. Welcome to Fresh Air, Paul.
Thank you, Terry.
You entered the seminary at age 14, and that just seems so very young to me to make a decision about how you want to spend your whole life.
Many people have wondered about that, and I myself wonder about it. From the haughty vantage point of 3.5 decades, it seems insane, I know. I must say that back then in the seemingly somnolent 50s, it made a certain sense. The logic, by the way, was derived from the Council of Trent in the 16th century, where you get a person young before he's corrupted by the vice of the world, and he is sort of taken away or takes himself away into this hermetically sealed environment and begins his studies for the priesthood. One of the old seminary buddies that I looked up in the course of the odyssey of writing this book, he said, "You know, Paul, you and I went to high school 400 years ago, and that's sort of it."
Well, your mother very much wanted you to go to the seminary, but did you feel at the age of 14 that you were called?
That word, calling, probably sounds musty now. Even the word vocation has a certain musty ring. I did, but like anything, it's a very complex issue. My mother was a very fervent and is Catholic Irish woman one of whose greatest dreams would be that a son would become a priest. So I was very much influenced by that. We were influenced by the nuns in grammar school. The important thing to know, Terry, is that these boys' seminaries, what I would call the kiddie ministry, this is where the best and brightest Catholic 50s boys went. This was not a liability to go into an institution and begin studying for the priesthood. It was the highest thing you could do. It was the diamond in the cap, the nuns would say.
This was the pre-Vatican II seminary. How did the seminary of the 1950s compare to the seminary today?
I entered the seminary. I got on a train on Michigan Avenue in Chicago and rode southward. And that in itself was something and is part of the story, to go into the lush fields of Alabama. I say in the book that there was nothing in the county where we were except hard shell Baptists and kudzu, which is a Japanese vine that grows everywhere in the South. And why a boys' Catholic seminary was located down there is part of the story. In brief, it's simply that the founder of the order had begun working on black rural missions in the South and decided to locate his seminary in the 1930s down there. But that in itself was an exotic, lush experience. At age 14 or even 13, some of us went. I was only a few months past my 14th birthday to get on this train and to ride 800 or 900 miles into the rural deep South and to begin this experience. It was, which is not really answering your question. I know you asked me about the 50s seminary. It was pre-Vatican II. Vatican II, as some of your listeners might not recall right off, was this worldwide gathering of bishops that began changing the church around drastically in their first convocation in 1962. And the church has never been the same. As you might say, the world has never been the same from the 60s themselves. So I got in sort of in that last calm period before the storm.
You say you were in love with the place in the early time that you were there. Why did you fall in love with it?
Well, there was such a spirit there, maybe a spirit that I have never found elsewhere. And I'm a very happily married man, and I have a son, a baby son I'm crazy about. But the collective spirit of young, highly idealized boys and men all working together in a unit. There were 100-some seminarians and a faculty of 20 or so priests and brothers. It provided a tremendous spirit, emotional spirit. Look, we were with each other constantly. We prayed with each other. We studied with each other. We hiked with each other. We went to the bathroom with each other almost literally because we sat in rows of stalls that were 8 and 10 deep. So, you know, that in itself suggests certain things. That, of course, there were vague, dim sexual innuendos and stirrings. But despite those, there was a collective spirit in that place and maybe a kind of holiness that I have not felt since. And a certain degree of this would be nostalgia talking, but I think that what I feel is deeper and richer and harder at the center than nostalgia.
You were living in an all-male society in the seminary, and I wonder if you had to like prove your masculinity to each other like boys of that age usually expected to do. And in the secular world, that's usually done through showing off about the kinds of dates that you can get. But since sexuality wasn't really a part of it, how was masculinity tested in the seminary?
Often on ball fields, in athletic endeavors. You know, we were constantly busy. We got up every morning at 5:30. 15 minutes later, we were in chapel. We had then meditation for a half hour. We had morning prayers and then meditation and then mass. Then began classes. What I'm leading up to saying is that there were only 50 minutes from 3:10 in the afternoon until 4 o'clock built in for physical recreation. And I'm telling you, after the intensity of all that prayer and study earlier, we ran our fool heads off on that basketball court. Or touch football that was touch in name only. So there was much of that going on in terms of proving things to one another. In some ways, you could liken it a little to a boys' prep school, but the major difference was that there was always, first and last, this great spiritual overlay that affected everything. We were there. See, we felt that we had a leg up on the world, and maybe the world didn't understand what we were doing or why we were there, but somehow we were going to save souls for Christ. And maybe that sounds pietistic and humanistic and a little ridiculous, but it provided a spirit that was pretty rich.
My guest is Paul Hendrickson, and he's the author of the memoir Seminary. He's also a reporter for the Washington Post. You were in the position of going through puberty away from home at the seminary, a place where sexuality is basically verboten. What kind of advice were you given from the priests who knew that sexual stirrings were starting to happen in your body and in the bodies of the boys in the seminary?
I guess what you would say in the shorthand answer is that there wasn't any given, or there was so little given, and it was so furtively given that it didn't help, or maybe provided more of a hindrance. Of course, we were emerging in our puberty. We were having our first sexual awakenings, and we were doing it in an all-male environment, and that provided tremendous inward tension, and it was going on in each of us, I'm certain, although I really can only and should only speak for myself. It provided tremendous inward tension that didn't quite have an outlet. You know, unfortunately, I've talked about the richness and the positive experience. There's tremendous negative baggage, emotional baggage that one brings with him into the rest of his life from an experience like this. And I think, unfortunately, that church of the 40s and the 50s and the decades before, the thought was that sexuality is bad. The body is for chastising. The mind is what's important. The mind will get you through. There were tremendous sexual things happening all around us in the school, but none of it was out in the open. And as I say, it made for a kind of fierce, humming, blooded presence, which no one quite was willing to talk about, although you could talk about it in spiritual direction. Spiritual direction, you would pick out one priest on the faculty and you would go to him. But for instance, such a thing as what was then called a nocturnal emission, which is essentially a wet dream. The first time that happened to me, I had not the faintest idea of what was happening with my body. I thought I might be having some sort of epilepsy attack, and I thought I had done something horrible. And I remember talking to my confessor about it the next morning before Mass so that I could go to communion. And he was on the dark side of the screen in the confessional box. And I can't swear to you that I heard a muffled titter, but I do recall that he sort of said, "Relax, son. You simply had a nocturnal emission." It had scared the bejesus out of me to be a little bit sacrilegious suddenly.
So there's probably a lot of guilt bound up in things that you were feeling then.
I think in anything, Terry, that you can't get out and express and simply show that you're human about, it would, as I say, create these inward tensions. But the negative residue from an experience like this, there is a great sense of guilt overlay that I think you take with you through the rest of your life. And I don't mean to sound accusatory. I don't mean to sound bitter. I don't think I'm either of those things. I think I simply am looking a little backwards with my eyes open now in the 1980s, a 43-year-old man trying to move onward and distill this rich, flawed, mysterious, even mystical experience.
You were in the seminary for the changes to Vatican II. What direct change did that create in your life?
I'm by no means, I should say quickly, any sort of authority on church change and the history of the Catholic Church, and I really wrote a personal book trying to describe my experiences. But essentially what happened, Terry, is this. Vatican II radically shook up the Catholic Church, turning the altar around, demystifying the priesthood. And a lot of things happened in that period. Seminaries began to close rapidly. You know, my seminary today is a Job Corps center. I actually have two seminaries because we moved buildings. And it's so painful to go back and see that building, that holy place, as a Job Corps center. I'm speaking of the institution that's in Virginia. The one in Alabama, which was the first one I went to, exists now as a kind of Catholic parish for just a sprinkle of blacks. When the 60s came along, what I try to say in seminary is that the things that were happening in the outer world, the things that eventually happened in the streets of Chicago at the convention at on the campus of Kent State, the war in Vietnam, the assassinations, all of that, our revolution was one wave behind that, and ours was not as bloodied. It wasn't so bloodied at all. And it wasn't celebrated. It wasn't on the front page of the New York Times, but it was a revolution all the same. And my seminary got affected. All the seminaries around us got affected. You know, I say in the book, just it's not a book of statistics, as you know, but I do say this. When I went to the seminary in 1958, there were 381 major and minor seminaries, Catholic seminaries in the United States. Within 20 years, 259 of those had closed. In my particular seminary, maybe 900 of us went through that place in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s. One guy from my class is a priest today. The whole school was closed. We all went out. We all went out beyond the walls.
Did you leave because of Vatican II?
It's a complicated answer. Of course we did. The world was changing faster than we could keep up with it. But I had my own internal demons and my own conflicts, and so I was leaving. I was leaving partially because of those, and I was leaving because of all the change in the outside world getting inside the walls. So of course Vatican II, but also a papal encyclical called Humanae Vitae, which actually is the birth control cyclical. And for guys who went on and stayed longer than I did and became priests, that encyclical was a terribly disillusioning thing in 1968. It basically reaffirmed that any sort of birth control is a mortal sin.
My guest is Paul Hendrickson, and we're discussing the subject of his memoir, which is called Seminary, and it's about his 7 years in a seminary. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Hendrickson is my guest. He's a Washington Post reporter who's also the author of the memoir Seminary, A Search. You went to two seminaries. The first one was in Alabama, and then you moved to one in Virginia. The one in Alabama was older. It was more rustic. It had a lot of old wood around. The one in Virginia, the way you describe it, they went out and they bought a lot of tacky furniture, a lot of formica in this. And I spent a lot of time thinking, and this bothered you a lot, and I spent a lot of time thinking whether it's a profound or a trivial problem that things were so tacky in the seminary.
I can't decide myself, and I'm sure that I had no awareness back then that formica-topped desks that you couldn't get all four legs ever to stand on the floor at once was any sort of a major problem. That sounds insane. In terms of speaking of all these verities and miracles and mystical sort of things, why would something as ethereal and superficial? But I think subliminally these things were working. They built this brand new building up in the upper south of Virginia. The order had sort of become mainstream church. Down in Alabama, we were rustic, we were poor. There was a sort of radical spirit of poverty. And when we got up to Virginia, the order had suddenly gotten millionaire donors, had sort of come into a mainstream acceptance. It had even commissioned a coat of arms for itself. For some reason, they built this beautiful new plant in Virginia with sturdy brick walls, but then inside, as I said, bought, for want of a better word, tacky furniture. And I remember when I went across the country and found my old mates, which is essentially the motif of this book, as you know. As the fellow said to me, Paul, it was as if we went to high school and college 400 years ago. Another guy said to me, he said, you know, I can suddenly think now, Paul, that when I got out of there, I had the strongest urge to be in a place where I could touch wood again.
Well, the church, especially the Catholic Church, has had a history of awe-inspiring architecture. Beautiful stained glass, fine painting. And, I mean, it does, things that are awe-inspiring like that do, can put you in touch with higher thoughts and, you know, formica can make it more of a challenge. But again, you wonder, is this something you should be transcending or something that this should actually
like
be allowed to matter?
It seems like something we should be transcending. I'm reminded suddenly of that Emily Dickinson poem. There's a certain slant of light on winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. And that to me is church, the heft of cathedral tunes on winter afternoons. Something ponderous and heavy, and yet mysterious and holy at the same time.
There was a letter that was sent out from the Holy See Sacred Congregation of Seminaries and Universities to bishops around the world, and it was about the seminary's role in teaching obedience. This was in 1959 when you were in the seminary. Would you read an excerpt of that letter for us?
Sure. This was... I'm quoting now from this letter of 1959. Let discipline, therefore, joyously embraced, be the touchstone by which superiors test the vocations of their students. Let them demand an obedience, not merely theoretical, but effective, single-minded, and complete in all things, great and small, contained in the seminary rule. Let them always remember that obedience primarily involves obsequium, that is, a total submission of mind and heart which makes our actions pleasing to God. If superiors can achieve this much, they can be assured that their students will also acquire the other virtues proper to a priest, especially those like chastity, which require manly willpower and perfect self-control.
I think that that letter really sums up one of the really big dilemmas for anyone in religion, which is the question of obedience and authority. Obedience to authority can be a discipline to basically get out of your own ego, to get out of the self. But you can also just end up, just being part of the bureaucracy and following people who aren't making good decisions about your life.
Of course, it seems to take away free will. It seems to take away individual choice. It seems to take away conscience. Does it take away conscience? I'm editing myself. But it seems to implant fear where choice and intellect should also have a huge place. I'm not sure they meant it that way, in the way, in a sense, we're talking about it. These were not malevolent people. These were people who had learned from their predecessors and were doing the best they could and were trying to make us into individuals who could go out and spread the faith. You know, the motto of my order was ad fidem servandam, for going out and preserving the faith and getting souls for Christ. And again, that From this complex, value-free world we live in, I put those things in quotes, that sounds a little something to snicker at. But you know, in some ways, we threw out the baby with the bathwater. Those old values, there are lasting good and deep things about them. My mother is a fervent churchgoer and has not quite understood all of the changes of the modern world. And I think she's better for it sometimes, not understanding.
You left the seminary about 6 weeks before it was time to take your vows, and that must have been maybe the most difficult decision you've ever had to make in your life. Why did you leave then? You'd spent so many years building to this, and then you bailed out at the last minute.
Even now, that haunts me. It wasn't working. I was about to say suddenly wasn't working. It hadn't been working for a year. I was in the period of novitiate, which is even a more rigorous training than the regular seminary. I was preparing to take vows, which would have been binding for 3 years, vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. At the end of that period, I would have taken them again, which would have been for life. In any case, to be dispensed from those vows, you would have had to go to Rome and go through long, difficult channels. So my name was Brother Garrett. I wore a religious habit. I was preparing to step forward and take these vows, and I left. It was an anguished decision, but somehow or other I had seemed to outgrow that life. It wasn't viable any longer. I had gone in there shortly after age 13, and now I was 21, and the world was changing, and I was changing. It was like a kid shooting out of his shoes. There was a growth imbalance. There was too much change, and I didn't feel I had a vocation any longer. And I use that old word a little bit ruefully and ironically.
It's interesting now, you're writing for the Washington Post Style section, and I'm sure you're writing a lot about popular culture, some of which you missed out on while you were in the seminary. Has it been hard to catch up on those years that you were cloistered?
I'm 43. I have a 3.5-year-old son, the only child. My life, you might say, has been a process of catch up, which is not all bad, I've come to understand. When I came out in the swamp hot summer of 1965, age 21, I didn't know who the Rolling Stones were. You know, I vaguely knew about the Gulf of Tonkin. It was somewhere over where a war was going on. I couldn't have begun to have told you where Vietnam was. I really was emerging from a kind of womb with, by the way, a buzz haircut, and I weighed 135 pounds. My wife now, who looks at those old pictures of me, she saw a picture that was taken 6 weeks after I left, and she said I looked like an escapee from Dachau.
You are, I'm sure, still wrestling with all of the religious questions that you wrestled with while in the seminary, but now you're living in the secular world and you don't even attend church regularly. Have you made your search a more secular search now?
Yeah. The last word in this book is search. I think the sentence is, for now, though, I keep searching. And incidentally, last Sunday I went to church. It was the first time in what? 2 or 3 years that I attended a Catholic service. I can't exactly tell you why. My old mates, whom I went and found in the course of writing this book, they say they slip into churches now and then at noon hours, and they don't particularly think of themselves as tragic. The old formulas and the old structures don't work anymore exactly, and yet there's the longing. There's the longing and the need somehow to be in touch with what? With the wood and not the formica.
But you're still searching.
I think I'll always be searching. I hope that that's what I'm about. I hope that's what being alive is about.
Paul Hendrickson, I want to thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Paul Hendrickson, and he's the author of a memoir titled Seminary, A Search, that's about the 7 years he spent in a seminary. It's published in paperback by Summit Books. He's also a writer for the Washington Post Style section. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.